that every year you say, and you keep saying it every year, and you realize, well, it's cliche, but it's absolutely true. Nick Ashew, at Nick Ashew on all the socials. Every week it feels like the NFL season goes by faster and faster, and every year it's the same thing where it's, my God, we're already in the Final Four. And that's exactly where we sit right now. Raphael Davis of the Big Ten Network jumps on with me now. And I mean, let me tell you something, Raphael. First off, like that UConn game and what happened to Duke and that comeback and all, like, we've seen UConn obviously in this position before. They've got the experience, they've got the coaching that's there. Look, I don't want to make this too poetic, but I'm going to do it, and you can tell me to calm down, and it's totally fine. But it kind of almost feels like UConn's got that, like, Team of Destiny feel after what they did against Duke. Am I completely overreacting, or do you see a level of momentum that could certainly carry over from that win?
No, yeah, they could carry some momentum over. But no, I appreciate you having me on. But they could carry some momentum over for sure. But I think you look at how they won. I mean, they needed Duke's help just a little bit. Like, Duke started turning it over. UConn started crashing the glass. So I think my college coach would always tell me, Matt Painter would always say, you start your next game how you finish your last game. So they could carry it over, but you look at Illinois. Illinois is, I mean, running the few, turns it over at the fewest rate in the country. They rebound at the highest rate in the country. They're not going to help you win. I think Duke got a lot of help towards that end of that game.
So let's look at this game against Illinois. Obviously, you mentioned a little bit in terms of, you know, that right there, but I kind of want to dig more into this matchup specifically. And if UConn is going to win this game, does it kind of cycle through the paint and Terrace Reed, or is it more than that?
I think they got to contain Terrace Reed, but I also think they got to attack Terrace Reed, if that makes sense. Like, I think the biggest way to contain Terrace Reed is to go at him on the offensive end and try to, because you look at Terrace Reed and you look at the numbers per 40 minutes, he's averaging around 4 fouls. So he's prone to pick up a few ones. So if you got Thomas Live and you can throw it down low and he can score the basketball at the rim, that gives you a chance that then maybe UConn, they got to send that double team, and then now you're playing off a closeout. But then also you look at the ball screen action, you look at Keen Wagler, his ability to shoot the bat, that's what UConn has in face this tournament. You look at Michigan State, Jeremy Fears, as great as he is, he's not a threat off the ball screen and shoot the three. You look at Duke with no healthy Caleb Foster, there wasn't a threat come off that ball screen. So you look at UConn when they play that drop coverage, King Wagner's going to be able to get what he wants. And then Tomislav Ivicic, his ability to pick and pop is something they haven't seen this tournament as well. You look at Duke, Gongba's not picking and popping. You look at Michigan State, Carson Cooper's not picking and popping. So if it's a night where Ivicic is making shots and Keaton is getting to his spot, it could be a long day in that ball screen, and Dan Hurley will have to change some things. So I think the best way to contain him is to make him guard on the defensive end and use that energy there.
You know, having three players in the starting rotation over the last couple of years for Dan Hurley, I know that's harder to get in college basketball, it feels like, at some of these top programs. Is that something that you would factor in heavily in this run in the tournament? Is it more on the coaching? I mean, I know we talk about guard play and there's a level of experience that obviously matters in the tournament. But, like, if you were weighing those two for UConn, would it be more about the coaching, or would it be more about the actual players that are out there?
Nah, man, I always say, you look at all the national champions that's come through, you look at all the greatest coaches that's coached the game, every time they have pros on that roster. Like, I get X's and O's are one thing, but when you get to tournament play, it's all about the Jimmys and the Joes. And you look at UConn, and you look at Terrace Reed, the dude's going to get drafted. Alex Caravan has won 17 NCAA tournament games. He's won 2 national championships. I mean, you go down the line, Braylon Mullins could be a lottery pick in his upcoming draft. He hits a shot, so you got a lottery pick to hit the shot. It's not like a scrub, you walk on or somebody hit the shot. So you got some guys on that team to go along with the great coaching, and it kind of combines together. But I'm always a dude that you look at the Final Four right now, King Wagner's a lottery pick. Yeah, Michigan has 4 first-rounders. Arizona has 2 top 10 guys and probably 4 or 5 draft picks. So when you got some pros, you think of the greatest teams that's done it, you think of Kentucky, Marcus Teague and those dudes, they had 8, 9 NBA players. That 09 UNC team has 7, 8 NBA players on that roster. Those are the teams that get it done at this time of the year. When you got some pros, you're going to win some games.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Keaton Wagler, who's really started to climb up a lot of draft board. And again, it's mock drafts, and I know we got a lot of time, but his name has been mentioned a lot more. And look, we know it's a very loaded draft class. There's a lot of talent that's going to be coming out. Obviously, in D.C., the Wizards are concerned with every single player that you're going to see or have seen in this tournament. Has Keaton Wagler been overlooked in terms of where his talent is? And is this now a chance for him to really put a spotlight on, potentially maybe even beyond this, like rising up draft boards even more?
Yeah, I mean, I look at King Wisner as the most impactful freshman to ever play college basketball. Like, ooh. I challenge you to think of some guys that, when you think about his numbers, his true value to that team, and their success where they are in the Final Four, I don't know if you can name me another freshman that's done that. You know what I mean? And if you can, I mean, you could if you want to try, but I think you look at King Wagler, and there's no other pros on that team. Like, there's no other draft picks on that team for this upcoming draft. You look at Illinois right now, they had one all-conference guy, first team, second team, third team, and it was King Wagler. Now, I don't know if a guy has ever, a freshman, has ever led their team. Like, you look at Greg Oden, got to the Final Four as a freshman. Mike Conley's still in the NBA today. You look at Anthony Davis, won the national championship. They had 6-7 pros on that team. You look at Carmelo Anthony, Hakeem Warwick was drafted in the first round. You know what I mean? So King Wagner is doing something truly, truly special. And when you're in real time, you can't really appreciate it. But for him to go out there as a freshman and not have any USA international experience, not go to a prep school, not play high-level AAU basketball, he could be the first one and done to never have done the former the three things I named, and I think that dude is special. He could go down as one of the better players to ever come through the Final Four.
That's definitely a great point in terms of just what he's got around him and how he's really carried this team. If you look at it, and obviously this comes from a Wizards perspective a little bit too, but beyond that, but I'll kind of tie the Wizards in a little bit. If we're looking at Keaton Wagler and how his game could translate to the NBA, since you brought it up, now I got to know, like, what do you see about Keaton Wagler that you think makes him that much, you know, a player that can really translate to the NBA quickly?
Because King Wagner could be Derek White for the Celtics. He can go to the team and fit in. Because you look at that Houston game, he didn't shoot it well against Houston, but he got you 10 rebounds. Like, he can guard it. So he can do those things, and he likes to do those things. He's fine with being a glue guy. He can go play hard and fit in the system and knock down shots. But he can also be Tyrese Halliburton. So he's a guy that can play off a ball screen, that can get you 20 every single night, that can get you 5, 6, 7 assists, that can rebound at a high level, and that can be a part of a winning team. So it's just I think he's a guy that you can plug and play, like a Yaxel Lindenberg, dudes that just can play any role at any time and really affect winning. I think what you get with King Wagner above anything is a winner. He won 2 state championships back-to-back, and then to go to the Final Four as a freshman as the leader of the team, I mean, that just says a lot about who he is as a player.
Talking to Rafael Davis here, and, you know, we've got 2 number ones playing in the later game in Arizona and Michigan, and you want to talk about some NBA prospects. There are definitely going to be some in that game. Tommy Lloyd also just got an extension with Arizona, so, I mean, that program continues to get back to, you know, what we've seen for so many years with Arizona in the past. Just big picture first, how do you see that game going, given what you've seen from both Arizona and Michigan in the tournament so far?
I got Michigan. I mean, I think the tournament's been going great for both teams. I think they both have shown how dominant they are. I think they've done it in different fashions. But when I look at the game, I know a lot of people will say they're very similar teams. And I think that's – I think you look at it and look at their size, you can say that, and it will make sense. But when you look at how they're playing the stylistics, it just doesn't. It just, they don't play the same. Like Arizona, they want to slow it down. They want to throw the ball inside. They want to dominate the paint, drive it. They want to get to the free throw line. They will score in transition, but they don't want to run too much. And they don't shoot a bunch of threes. So I look at that, and that's a traditional Big Ten team. I mean, that's what you get with Michigan State every single year almost. And I think so Michigan could be prepared for that in a lot of ways. But I think when you look at Michigan, they're big, but and they're fast. They want to run. They want to score 100. They want to shoot a bunch of threes. So I think Michigan wins this game. I think they win it pretty handily. I'm real bullish on Michigan all year long. I think they win the national championship. I think this Michigan team could go down as one of the better college teams when we look back at it 20 years from now.
What is it about Dusty May as a coach that just really shows it's translated to different programs for him, success-wise?
He's the greatest GM to ever be a part of college basketball. He gets it. He gets it at a pro level. Like, he gets it. Like, he gets it in the sense of he knows how to relate to guys. He knows how to get guys to respond. He gets this era of generation of guys. So his ability to adapt to this generation has been big time, and his ability to get guys to buy in and be on the same page year in and year out, I think that says a lot about who he is as a coach.
You know, it's interesting you say that because, we're obviously seeing how college basketball and college football is in a similar position, too, where you're, you know, NIL and the transfer portal, and programs are essentially hiring general managers, and coaches have to think more of the way that they are in the NBA level. Do you see maybe more coaches from the NBA looking at college saying, I could go there now because it will be a little bit more of a model that's closer to the NBA at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think a little bit, but you also think about the NBA is a little different. Everybody's extremely talented. College, you still got to work for some guys. So I think it's still your pros and your cons. But I mean, college is at the point now where it's similar to the league in the sense of players have more control, and I like that about it. So I just think at the league, the level of talent, that's the biggest differentiator above everything, because everybody is a pro. Everybody's expected to make shots. Everybody's expected to do certain things. And at the collegiate level, you still got freshmen. You still got 17-year-olds at that time, and you got to grow with them mentally at times.
All right. When we're looking at the national championship game, what two teams are in it, and who wins the national title?
Michigan and Illinois are in it. We're going to do 1989 all over again, but instead of the semifinals, we're going to do it in the national championship, and Michigan going to win it. I got Michigan winning a close one against Illinois, and the Big Ten is going to win the first national championship in the last, 26 years? I think it's going to be a good year for the league.
All right, there you go. Rafael Davis, Big Ten Network, really appreciate you coming on. Thanks for the time.
Oh, no, thank you, and I just want to say shout-out to my grandmother, Margaret Williams.
All right. You know what? I will say this, too. If you look at this tournament, it is you have three of the 4-1 seeds in the final four, and yet you're still – or sorry, you have – sorry, you did two of the – two of the, let me try this again. Jeez, I'm looking at something in front of me right now here. Two of the 1 seeds in the final four, but you still have a 2 seed, you have a 3 seed, you had another 1 seed in the Elite Eight. You have this level of – We don't have parity necessarily in college basketball like it might have been before, but what you do have is kind of like parity at the top, right? And, you know, talking to Rafael a little bit about that, like college basketball has changed. It's changed a lot, and you're in a position now where you have to kind of treat your team like, yeah, you're not dealing with the same level of talent that you have in the NBA, but you have to kind of think about it not just from a recruiting perspective, but it's sort of, it's free agency without a salary cap until it changes. And this gives programs an opportunity to turn things around. And you have it in college football. And we saw it in the college football playoff. But you also have it here where, you know, you can turn programs around quickly if you're really good at poaching from other programs. It was Indiana in college football. And, you know, Michigan has a turnaround pretty quickly here, talking about Dusty May and, you know, his ability to, yeah, like these are the types of things you have to have now. It's not just sitting in a living room with a 16 or 17 or 18-year-old and convincing them to come play for you and they'll probably stay. No, it's, you got to get the guys there. They got to want to stay. And then you've also got to go poach from other programs. It's cutthroat, man. But it also allows for an opportunity for programs to turn around quickly. It also, on top of that, gives a chance for a level of parity at the top of college basketball, but not to the point like, look at the women's tournament versus the men's. It's the same Final Four in the women's back-to-back years. It's all 1 seeds. It's all the best. Like, the talent is really, it's much more top-heavy on the women's side than the men's side. The men's side, though, has higher seeds in the Final Four, but you do have it spread out a little bit more. So it's like, those are the levels of, you still have parity, but it's parity with the top. And I think it's going to be hard. You're still going to have Cinderellas, but I do think that we are seeing, at least right now, with NIL and the transfer portal, because you can see players that will go play for a smaller school. Maybe you win a tournament game or two. You just get to the round of 32 even, whatever, and then you transfer to UConn in a year, and you're playing for FAU or something like that the year before. I mean, you're going to see more of that because there's more exposure, and then there's an opportunity to get poached, transfer, go somewhere else. So you're going to start to see these players on smaller programs that have a lot of talent that maybe weren't recruited enough get on that national stage, get out there in the tournament, and then instantly, boom, they go somewhere else. So you're still going to see the big guys getting a lot of that talent. Some of it's just going to be from poaching from other programs, though. And that's where we sit. And it's it's the reality of college basketball at this point. It is. But we still have a really good Final Four. These are some damn good teams. And I'll tell you this, if UConn wins another national championship, I mean, we've absolutely got to say that this is, I mean, it's a dynasty, right? It's got to be a dynasty. All right, I'm Nick Ashew. There is no way that if UConn wins the national title, we cannot talk about them as a dynasty. 3 titles in the last 4 years. I mean, it's just, You go back and look at college basketball and how spread out these championship-winning teams have been. And, yeah, we go back to Billy Donovan winning a couple in a row. Even then, that was a short-lived era, and then you got guys going to the NBA, and then he goes off to the NBA and coaches a couple of teams. I mean, Dan Hurley had his choice of jobs. The Lakers wanted him. That was close. And yeah, he's in a great spot. He is the hero. He's beloved at UConn. He's a crazy person. He probably wouldn't work well in the NBA anyway because – can you really imagine? Again, I root for chaos. You know that? Sometimes, not always. I rooted for the chaos with the Lakers. Imagine Dan Hurley just yelling at LeBron James. I mean, come on. We all wanted it to happen. Didn't happen. But this is such a great spot for this team to be in again after all of the success they've had in terms of, you know, the recruiting and the just giving yourself some level of momentum and building the program's reputation back up after the Kevin Ollie years that were great at first, but it really wasn't him that did the recruiting, and then it was a disaster. And it's Dan Hurley's such a great coach. I mean, I don't know how he could be so intense nonstop. I mean, listen, I'm a high-energy guy, but he's next level. But there's just no way that you can look at this UConn team and not say dynasty if they were to win. Now, you got to get through Illinois. You got to get through the winner of the Arizona-Michigan game and, you know, all that. But this is... this UConn team is going to be in the conversation of dynasty. And listen, either way, you could come right back next year, stock up with a little bit more talent, and you're back in there again, and it's like you're in the Final Four this year, and next year you're in the national championship game. I mean, it's really tough to have a level of consistency in college basketball because you're going to have some one-and-dones. Every program has some level. I mean, we're looking at the NBA draft here, and the top 10 to maybe top 12 picks in the NBA draft in June could all be freshmen. It's the one and done has been, I mean, it's been a thing for a while. Some programs have embraced it, some haven't. As sports evolve, every league, just like any business, just like the world, if you don't evolve with it to a point, you're going to be left behind. There was a point where Clemson was the premier program in college football, and Dabo Sweeney said, I ain't changing, and we're not doing all this transfer portal nonsense, and, well, what's happened now? He's up at the podium telling people to fire him. I mean, that's how this past season went for Clemson. You have to be able to evolve with it. It was always surprising to me that Coach K was willing to do that. You know, as a very old-school college basketball coach in a lot of ways, it was always very surprising that he wanted some of those young players. But it worked, and then Duke just transitioned right over with John Shire. And, you know, they mix in some upperclassmen and at least some guys that stay 2 years, and that's really what you need. Look, Dan Hurley's got three players in his starting rotation that have been a part of the system the last 2 years. That's tough to have. That's tough to get. And again, like when you're recruiting, and let's just look at recruiting before we even start talking about transfer portal. When you're looking at recruiting, you want to get the most talented players, but the most talented players, the top ones, usually looking at college basketball as a pit stop. So if you're embracing that, even to a point, you got to be able to surround them with some other players. You got to be able to surround with some other talent. But you can't tell me that there isn't some level of like Team of Destiny feel with UConn. I mean, to be down 19 to Duke and hit a 35-footer, now it's going to go down as one of the most iconic shots along with Villanova winning the national championship at the buzzer. I mean, these are iconic moments. There's a built-in level of like mental momentum. And momentum is a fickle beast in basketball. I always say that. Like, you could watch a game and again, you're down 19 and you end up winning this game. Momentum went clearly in the other direction from Duke to UConn and what we were able to get. I love UConn in this game. And it's not even necessarily about a matchup as much as it is about the coaching, the players, the experience, and the momentum that they have. I mean, it's really what it is. And yes, Illinois's got a player that's going to be a top 10, maybe top 5 pick in the draft, but it's him and everybody else. UConn has more balance, they have more depth, and UConn's got a coach that understands what it's like to be in this position, and he's an absolute crazy person. I mean, Michigan is in a really good spot too, but you've got Arizona to get through. I mean, for Michigan, you don't have to see Duke, which is good, right? There's no Duke in their path now for the national championship game. Duke was one of the few teams that could figure him out during the regular season. But, you know, Dusty May put this roster together in Michigan in essentially under a year, and it shows too, right? Like, this is where that this is where that quick turnaround in college basketball can happen. It can happen in college football to a point, too. But, you know, we start looking at the transfer portal and start looking at, again, free agency without a salary cap. You can build a team up quick. You really can. And it's not, I mean, it's not a guarantee, but you've really changed the landscape. And, you know, if we just had a guest a little while ago. That's just that. Dusty May is basically a GM. And that's kind of where college sports has gone now. Love it or hate it, that's just the reality of it. I mean, it is. There's a reason why Bill Belichick went to North Carolina and got himself a GM. You're not going to have these deep front offices like you have in the NFL or the NBA, but you're going to have more of that. You have to take that approach. And when rules change, when trends change in any business, any industry, the people that can kind of see how you can manipulate those and take advantage of it in the early years, that's where the success is. And the best programs in college basketball and college football are, they're going to be in a spot to succeed because they've found ways to work with the new rules that are there. And I think that's what we're going to start to see more and more of, where, yeah, you'll occasionally get that Cinderella. Yeah, you'll occasionally get that program that sneaks its way through. But will they be back? No, because most of those guys will end up transferring to a bigger program. Or the coach leaves and poaches a bunch of guys with him. That's how Indiana built a football program, right? Kurt Cignetti took everybody from JMU. I mean, again, he's a really good coach, but it does help. I mean, Dion did it with Colorado. Not like they were that good, but I think coaches will leave. Like, you just, there's so much turnover in college sports now. It's aggressive, and you have to stick with it. You're always on. You're always recruiting, and you're always, like, it's recruiting within the recruiting. Because once you recruit the guys, you got to make them hope that they all stay there. And not every player is going to stay. It's like not every draft pick is going to hit in the NFL draft, but you need to have a good percentage, right? Like, you need to be shooting about 80% from the free throw line there for that to work out. And you start having a lot of turnover, that's where the problems kick in. But you can't look at UConn at this point and not just see something special from this team. And experience goes a long way. Guard play goes a long way. Experience goes a long way. Like, you can't just, again, go back and look, like, teams winning with one and dones, team winning with really good freshmen in this era of college basketball. They've also still had veterans around them because this is still a situation. You need that calm voice. Like, we talk about locker room guys with the Commanders all the time. I know you're probably sick of Bobby Wagner, but Bobby Wagner had value beyond just one of the few guys that actually could tackle on that defense. That stoic voice, that calm presence, that veteran that's been there, because it's one thing for a coach to say it, but if it's a player that's acting also as a coach that has done it on the field, that makes a huge difference. And to have the same thing in March Madness, where you've got players that have been in these tournament situations over the last couple of years. They understand the close games. They understand the pressure. They understand what it takes to succeed. And, you know, when you see, right, when you're on a flight and the flight attendants are chilling and there's a bunch of turbulence, you know, all right, I'm cool. You start seeing them panic, that's when you get worried. And it's kind of the same thing. When the vets start to panic, then everybody else, all the underclassmen are panicking on top of that because you're going, oh, God, this is probably a bad sign here. This has been a good tournament, though. I mean, we haven't had, like, a ton of buzzer beaters, haven't had a ton of Cinderellas. I think we've had the right balance. And you've got a lot of young talent we've been able to see go through this tournament. Cameron Boozer winning AP Player of the Year. Duke at least gets to an Elite Eight. And whether you love Duke or hate Duke, they're a polarizing team. You've got the big programs, and you've got, you know, a lot of stories around them. People like storylines. It's what makes the Olympics interesting, right? They give you the storylines on athletes you've never heard of. You get a lot of storylines, and you get background in a lot of these programs or players there, and it makes it more interesting. And I think it's been a good tournament. I really do. And the ratings have certainly shown it, too. Again, they're rating things a little bit differently now, but, you know, you've had the blue bloods, you've had the big programs, and it's given us what we've looked for. It feels like it goes by so quick and kind of just fizzles towards the end, though. I think it's just a long layover. Right, you're not going to now have anything all week, and then tomorrow we've got the Final Four, and then Monday's the national championship game. You kind of just watch it and go, like, wow, that happened really fast, but here we are. So a couple of really good games tomorrow. Obviously Arizona and Michigan, though. That's the premier one, but we'll see. Could end up getting a blowout. Could end up getting a one-sided one when it's all said and done. Nick Ashew on The Fan. It is so obvious what the Eagles are trying to do. They are just setting up the blueprint now. Nick Ashew on the Fan. The Eagles are setting up a Jalen Hurts divorce. This is such a pivotal year for them and for him, and when you have all this stuff leaking over the last couple of days about, well, you know, he's not a great leader and he's rigid and doesn't buy into things, what you're doing is discrediting his leadership, who he is as a teammate, who he is as, in some ways, a person. And when you're a quarterback, you can't have that be done. That can't be a thing. And when you start discrediting a player's leadership and maturity that's in that position, it's one thing if it's like a tight end or a linebacker. Like, just go out and tackle people. Just go lower your shoulder. Go out and catch footballs, whatever. Like, there's a different standard that's being held to somebody that plays that position. And, yeah, I get it. People go, oh, he won a Super Bowl, Super Bowl MVP. And, like, yes, but did you watch the offense this past season? And if we're being honest with ourselves, go back to that Eagles Super Bowl run. For a lot of it, in the end, Jalen Hurts won. Like, Jalen Hurts was a big part of that win in the Super Bowl, but most of that season and most of the games leading up to that, it was about Saquon Barkley and that offense, and in bare minimum, the threat of Saquon Barkley. Because you knew that Saquon Barkley, in the historic season that he had, at any moment in any game, could break off a massive run. Even the quiet first halves would lead to big second halves. We saw it. And if you're sitting and looking at what this Eagles offense looked like last year, you're removing another offensive coordinator, you're changing the offense again, but you didn't have the same Saquon Barkley. And are you ever going to get that back? Even close. I mean, I'm not even talking first year Eagles, like historic season. I'm talking just Pro Bowl caliber, though that word means nothing anymore. Running back. Because running backs hit a wall real quick. Not every time, but you can sometimes not see it and it just comes out of nowhere. And there's a very real chance that that could be the case. So if you're the Eagles, the first thing you do is start to put the blame on the quarterback, the one you're paying all this money to, the one that's great with the tush-push but really inconsistent throwing the football. And it's true, he is. Like, we can't pretend that that's not the case. It's always been a question. But you see the moments and you see the oohs and ahs, and then you see other times where he's inaccurate or the offense just isn't going anywhere. And again, I understand that some of this is play calling and some of this is the offensive coordinator. So that could change. But why is this stuff coming out? This is calculated. When this stuff happens, when reports from anonymous sources within a team, it is calculated. It is leaked on purpose. And this is an opportunity for the Eagles to set the groundwork, lay the cement for a foundation of moving on after this season. I really see that happening, especially if A.J. Brown's gone too on top of that. Because A.J. Brown doesn't want to be back. Now, it's not the same situation as Brandon Ayuk. If you're the Eagles, you're going to want to try to keep that together. I mean, that at one point, A.J. Brown was one of the best receivers in the NFL. If he still is, well, that's another question. We may not ever get that same A.J. Brown again, but you know, he clearly doesn't get along. And there were reports during the season too, right? A lot of like, well, most of the offense kind of doesn't really get along with Jalen Hurts, or, you know, these receivers aren't really in sync with him, and it was kind of more than just on the field. Like, they don't really get along. Not that they, like, hate each other, but there's just no chemistry. These types of things were slowly creeping out, and as this came out, it's been the conversation the last couple days, and you could just see it. You can see it. Look, there's no question quarterbacks need consistency, even if there's maybe a little bit of a lower ceiling than some others. It's why I just so adamant about the Commanders having a consistent offense and having a consistent play caller. And I, if David Blau is as good of an offensive coordinator as people seem to think he's going to be, he's going to be a head coach. The question is when? He's 30 now. Does he stay 5 years and at 35 still is really young and gets a head coaching job? He'll take interviews within a couple of years, maybe even after this season. If the Commanders have a great season offensively this year, David Blau is getting head coaching interviews. You understand that, right? He may not be around that long. If they're that good, he could go the Ben Johnson route, wait a little bit longer for just the right situation for him, or he could just say in a year or two, I'm ready to do this. I don't know. I'm not in his head. But that's a real possibility, and that's why you've got to have a succession plan in place and understand who's going to take over if he does move. And you want it to be somebody within the organization, and you want it to be somebody that you can just elevate. Because with Jaden Daniels having missed basically his entire sophomore season, you're now heading into year three for somebody that has 1 year of experience that was fantastic his rookie year and non-existent his second year. You don't want to be what Jalen Hurts was with six offensive coordinators in 6 years basically now. That's Jason Campbell-type inconsistency. Now, I'm not saying Jason Campbell could have ever been a Super Bowl-winning quarterback, but he's a good quarterback. He probably would have been better had he had some consistency early in his career, and that's really the big thing, is it's about the consistency in the early stages, developing good habits, developing better techniques, learning, identifying, and a level of confidence. Like, that matters, too. It's like I talk about UConn and this wave of momentum after beating Duke the way they beat Duke. That's a mental side. The mental side of sports gets overlooked so much, but it's so massively important if you can understand it. And the mental side, the confidence of a young quarterback getting consistent opportunities to succeed with the same thing over and over again, not just learning how to drive, but learning how to do all, right? It's like all the little things. Remember when you were learning how to drive? I learned how to drive with a manual first, a stick. No kids drive stick anymore. It's not even a thing. Kids these days. But, you know, it's like when you're learning how to shift gears and do it the right way and the clutch and handle all these different things. Oh, and how to make a left turn on top of it. That's a lot of moving parts. But start off driving an automatic, one thing at a time. Learn. It's easier. You can think. It slows down for you. It's the same thing with a young quarterback. You want that offense to slow down. You want it to be second nature. You want it to be something where then it's mastered and you can say, let's start layering in some new stuff. Week 7, week 8, week 9. Because it's not about like the next season. It's about midway through the season. Ask Cliff Kingsbury, right? It's great the first 8 weeks. What about the second half? Don't forget, Jim Zorn started off 6-2 as a head coach. And oh gosh, gee golly, everybody thought he was going to be a great head coach. And they finished 2-6. So the NFL catches up to you real fast. And look, I'll say this. The NFC and the NFC East specifically, very wide open. I'd argue very vulnerable right now. The Eagles are very vulnerable at the top. And it's what made last year so frustrating. I mean, there's a million reasons that made it so frustrating. But, man, if you think of last year, I mean, the Commanders coming off a 12-win season, only win 5 when the Eagles were not the same Eagles team that you saw 2 years ago that beat them in the NFC Championship game. That was a vulnerable division, and it's very wide open this time around. Because really, the Eagles have an elite defense, there's no question, and they have, I think, 9 draft picks, and Howie Roseman knows how to draft. So don't get me wrong, I recognize it. They'll probably draft a receiver, and they're going to try to fill a lot of these gaps. But if you have questions at quarterback, that has a trickle-down effect across the board, and the Eagles are very, very vulnerable right now. Again, a lot of this can change. We might feel totally different about the Eagles come training camp. But right now, the NFC East is very vulnerable. And I'd argue the NFC as a whole is very vulnerable. There's a reason why the Rams went F them picks one last time. This one last ride with Matt Stafford. Might be one season. They just said, screw it, we're going all in. Get yourself a couple of new corners. You saw what your offense could do last year when they were healthy. Matt Stafford stays healthy. I mean, this team could be in a Super Bowl next year at SoFi, by the way. You know? So there is a very, very good chance that the NFC could look very different. Now, could the Bears be better? Yeah, there's a chance. Year two under, you know, Ben Johnson, absolutely a possibility. But if you look, it's, to me right now, it's the Rams and everybody else. And it's a whole other tier with everybody else. And it's an opportunity for anybody, including the Commanders, I'm not saying they're going to be the second best team in the NFC by any stretch. I just spent half this time, as we all have, talking about the needs they still have. But they are way better. I mean, they have made a lot of improvements. And if the free agent signings they've made, if those guys live up to and if not exceed the expectations and the contracts they were given, then they're in good shape, especially defensively. Still have needs, still have things. I mean, they're at best probably a wild card team, but could maybe win the division. If the Eagles can't do anything offensively for another year, if they're limited and they can't score, I mean, it's the point where you're down a touchdown in the third quarter and you're like, well, the Eagles are going to lose because they can't score. And Saquon's not ripping off big runs. And if your quarterback can't get the football to his receivers, I mean, what are you doing? Right? Receivers are overpaid decoys if you're not putting the football in their hands. That's kind of what it comes down to. And it's a very, very vulnerable division. Don't get me wrong. Eagles are still the best team in the NFC East as of now. But that could very much change. And be interesting to see how much the Rams push for A.J. Brown, because they have. They've been trying to get A.J. Brown, but if you're the Eagles, you're like, do we want to trade him to the Rams? We could maybe see him in the playoffs or just make the best team in the NFC better. Patriots, if I'm the Eagles, I want to trade A.J. Brown to the Patriots. That's for sure. I want him in the AFC. I want him far away. You don't want to send him to a place where he succeeds again, too, because it's just like Brandon Ayuk, like I was talking about before, right? I mean, if you're the 49ers, you don't want to see Brandon Ayuk go somewhere else and succeed right away. Makes you look bad. Well, if you're the Eagles, it's the same thing. A.J. Brown goes to the Rams, goes to the Patriots, balls out, 1,000 yards, 80 catches, 7 or 8 touchdowns even. You're just like, where was that for us? Well, that shows you then it reflects back on them. So that's the whole other issue. Teams think about this stuff because that's an image thing, and that stands out. And that's something that will absolutely bother them. Don't get me wrong, Howie Roseman will go out and find another receiver. I hate to say it. I mean, he's the best GM in the NFL. Right now, he is. See if that changes. But as of now, very, very vulnerable NFC East. Nick Ashew on the Fan. The women's game is very, very top heavy. A lot of the same pro. I mean, you know, you don't have the talent as spread out there yet. A lot less parity at the very top of that. But you know, these have been good tournaments, man. I'm gonna miss March Madness. Have you noticed though? There's definitely the highest amount of excitement, right? The first weekend. That's where it all is, and then you still have the Sweet 16. And it's like gets quiet real quick, unless your team's in it. You went to that school, or unless you're like Wesley, who you know just. You Tech fan, but Ohio State fan, and we don't really know, depending on what the game is. So it's just kind of deal with what Harold has to do. When Harold has to...
different keeping people on my toes. That's what I do.
that's usually what it is. It's just keep people on your toes. So, the thing about college basketball for me, it's... for me personally, I always know, like, George Mason, we already had our run, right? Like, that's it. That one Final Four, that was it. Won a tournament game over. Actually, we beat your Buckeyes, if I remember correctly. That's right. We did beat your Buckeyes 1 year in the first round. So that was fun. And that's pretty much it. It's the bigger programs, you know. It's you have higher expectations than what somebody that goes to a mid-major ends up having. You just want to be in the tournament. Hey, it's fun. And that's what makes it cool at the beginning because you got so many people involved. And then you just kind of go, well, that was fun. Now we're on to the Blue Bloods. And here we are. So, it's... It has that feeling of dwindling. Then we'll be all in the NFL draft again. Lots of NFL draft. I'm still praying the Commanders trade down. It's tough because again, that at number 7 there are so many spots available. Like there's some talent that's there, right? There's no question. There is talent that's available. But you also have so many needs where that valuable real estate at 7 might be worth considering. I mean, unless there's somebody that you think is a cannot miss prospect, and that's so dangerous. It's like a can't miss bet. Well, no, it's possible. It happens. But I mean, you know, Sonny Styles and David Bailey are both on the board, it's really hard to not take one of those guys. I mean, maybe Reuben Bain, but you could at least justify and say he's got short arms, so we don't want to draft him. You know, I mean, even a Caleb Downs. That's the thing. You're going to have at least one potential difference maker defensively on the board at 7. So that's really where they have to weigh this. Like again, that's part of what sometimes in the past, it's just like you have one or two guys, right? I feel like half the time it's been quarterback, let's be honest. And isn't that a good feeling too? Like, let's be honest with ourselves here for a second. We're not talking about a quarterback in this draft. Well, maybe they'll reach and draft. No, we don't have to do that. So that's part of the reason why it kind of can look around and go, there's a bunch of directions they could go. But that's part of just the interest for me here is, more than anything, what is going to be the decision they make and what's the justification for it? Like, if they do go Carnell Tate, is it just that you felt he is the potential number one for you once you move on from Terry McLaurin, which is going to happen? Is it that you just felt like he's a can't-miss prospect in general, that you felt like that gap in the number two spot at receiver is more important than any of the needs you still have on defense because of what you've done? This, you know, and you may not get the full answers from Adam Peters and Dan Quinn and everybody else, the press conferences afterwards, but that's what we're talking about here right now, is the potential for so many different directions for this team to go. And I mean, I think about it so much over the years with these drafts we've had in the past, and it's always kind of felt like there was a general idea, right, of what position they could at least draft. They're at least going to go, I mean, let's take quarterback out of it because that's been a thing so often. It's like, well, they really need an offensive lineman. It's probably between these two tackles. Or, you know, they really need an edge rusher. I mean, you go back to Chase Young, and we just thought, oh, it was going to be Chase Young, and it was, and it didn't work out. But, I mean, we've been talking Jeremiah Love, Sonny Styles, Carnell Tate, David Bailey, Mansoor Delane, Caleb Downs, Mekhi Lemon. I mean, this, we're talking wide receiver, corner, linebacker, edge. I mean, safety, and it's just like running back. Oh, and you could justify every one of those picks. Really, you could. Like, here's the thing. As much as I want the Commanders to go defense in this draft, in the end, if you're in the same boat as me and you want defense, if they draft Jeremiah Love, you may go, oh my God, we need more on defense, but at the same time, you're going to start thinking about what Jaden Daniels and Jeremiah Love look together in this offense, right? I will. I'll admit it. Of course I will. It's the same thing with Carnell Tate. All right, well, oh man, this could still be really good at least. They're going to give up a lot of points, I think, still, but hey, you know, at least they got a number two receiver in theory. There's just so much available, and it's like there's no quarterbacks in this first round. But you've got so many other positions where there's actually a lot of depth. Next year, at least now, in theory, everybody's looking at it like, that's going to be the quarterback draft. Well, we thought this was going to be the quarterback draft. But as of now, that's the case. And it's a nice feeling to be, isn't it? Where you don't have to sit there and go, oh my God, we don't have a quarterback. Oh, and there's nobody this offseason. In the past, it would have been like, well, maybe Kyler Murray, right? That's where the Commanders would have been. You would have been in the Tua and the Kyler boats. Or hoping that Aaron Rodgers wants to come over for a season or something. I mean, the pickings were slim. So to be in that position, and this is why teams will overpay to keep quarterbacks, because even if you have a quarterback that's a B-plus quarterback, it's better than searching for a D-minus quarterback and trying to figure out who's going to be your bridge quarterback for a season. And it gives you the freedom to start looking at other positions where you can at least justify taking a dynamic player in Jeremiah Love or a versatile defensive player in Sonny Styles that can play multiple positions, or a monster edge rusher in David Bailey. Like, all those are justified choices, every single one of them. And quite frankly, all of them fit needs to a point, too. To a point. And you look around, and it's just like, this is a really good spot for them to be in. But you have to also, if you're this front office, look and say, all right, here's a flashy luxury move, but what's the smart move? And sometimes those don't go hand in hand. Sometimes you're lucky enough where that could be the case, and it works out. I'm just still not convinced that they're in the place where they should be drafting somebody like a Jeremiah Love, and I'd argue even a Carnell Tate or any wide receiver. Given who's available, that changes things to a point, but you know they've still got a lot of needs defensively. And if they can't figure out what they're going to do at receiver, there is going to be a gap, and I understand that. But you can still find talent in you can find a receiver in the third round. I mean, look at Terry McLaurin, right? Like, I understand it's not a guarantee, but you can have all the picks in the world. If you can't identify talent in the draft, it really doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't. You can have 10 picks. If you can't find and see a guy that's going to translate from one level to the other, who cares? Really? The picks mean nothing. So having the ability to identify how a player can fit in your system. I mean, Jamin Davis, let's be real. I mean, it was a bust from the beginning. We could go down the list, but it's, you know, first-round pick, you're getting a linebacker. I think he's a good high floor. It's just, right? And we could go, I mean, Ryan Anderson, second-round a linebacker. Sua Cravens, didn't really even want to be there. And these are players that had a lot of talent in college. Doesn't translate to the NFL. You got to be able to see that. And some of this also, too, is where, like, these interviews and talking to coaches and finding out behind the scenes the personality that's there. It's part of the reason why the Eagles are, right? Personality factors into a lot of this. It taints somebody's reputation. It's why there's these leaks from the Eagles about Jalen Hurts. Same thing. I mean, I hate to say it, but sometimes there's attacking character. And it also, the water gets muddied a lot in the NFL draft anyway. People are leaking other things, and agents are trying to get narratives out to get their clients drafted higher, and other teams are trying to leak stuff so that player can fall and go to them. That happens. It's dirty pool, but it absolutely happens. I mean, who knows? There might be a team like if you look at the draft, I'm trying to see who could really, I mean, I doubt you could see any way Jeremiah Love drops the 10 to the Bengals, but they might be a team. They just leak something. They're like, oh yeah, I heard Jeremiah Love is two heads, and he's hiding one. I don't know. I'm just throwing something stupid out there. But you know how it is, and then all of a sudden, Jeremiah Love's dropping in the draft. Why? And then he goes to the Bengals, and you find out later it was all just leaked. I mean, this guy, stuff will be leaked. I mean, it happens all the time. It's lying season. We got 3 more weeks of this, too. Get ready, because there's going to be more. There's going to be more lies. Hell, the Commanders could trade down in the first round. What if the Commanders traded down to 16 and took Jordan Tyson at that point and you get a wide receiver, but you get a second round pick from the Jets and you get 44. I'd take that too. I'd trade 7 to 11 and get pick 43 as well in the second round from the Dolphins. What about 7 to 16 and then also getting 44 in the second round from the Jets? I'd take that. I mean, these are the types of scenarios where these are spots. Now, granted, the Dolphins trade would be better. That's 4 picks back versus 9. And you're going to get a little bit more at 11 than you are at 16. But getting back in the second round, it would be massive for this team. It really would. But you've got options. You've got a lot of options sitting there at pick 7. Trading back, multiple guys that can help you defensively, maybe wide receiver. But you could get a receiver in the second round, defense in the first round. That's just, it'd be perfect. Nick Ashew on the Fan.